Once upon a time, journalists were trusted to hold those in power to account.
Deep Throat urged Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein to follow the money.
But now trust in mainstream media is disappearing, paving the way for conspiracy.
Pizzagate is real.
The satanic temple of Jeffrey Epstein.
I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we dive deep into the stories and dispel the rumours. New episodes on ABC Listen every Tuesday and Thursday.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today it's a conversation with author and New York Times columnist M. Gessen. M. Gessen grew up in the old Soviet Union. The family migrated to the United States when M. was 15. But after the collapse of the old regime, they returned to Russia to cover the brief flourishing of democracy in the 1990s, and then the slow, ugly slide back down into autocracy, into one-man rule under Vladimir Putin. M. Gessen's experience in Russia makes them one of the most clear-eyed commentators on the shocking dismantling of America's democratic institutions under President Donald Trump, something he promised to do, even as he was running for office. The Trump administration might seem chaotic and bewildering to outsiders, but M's insight into the mindset of the autocrat and the wannabe autocrat offers some clarity in why such leaders do the things they do and how they see the world and what makes people like Donald Trump so incredibly compelling to his followers. This conversation was recorded on Tuesday evening this week at the Brisbane Powerhouse for the Brisbane Writers Festival.
Thank you.
In Australia, we're watching the events in the United States from a distance. You've lived through these moments twice now, on two occasions in Russia, now with the creeping autocracy in the United States. I just wonder if that's got a kind of a texture to it or a flavour to it. What does it feel like to be living in a country that's going through this experience where its democratic institutions are slowly being strangled?
Well, you said two words, creeping and slowly, that I would not exactly apply to the United States. Creeping and slowly was true of the rise of Vladimir Putin and his autocratic state. And I think of all the contemporary autocracies that I've certainly written about or reported on, in the U.S., it's happening really fast. In a sense, perhaps the effect is the same, because I remember what felt probably the worst in Russia was that something shocking would happen. They would start jailing people for peaceful protest. It was 14 years ago that they put somebody in prison for the first time for peaceful protest, but that means 12 years into Putin's presidency. And you think, I can't breathe, I can't live with this. And then the next day you get up and the sun is shining or doing its thing in Moscow, not necessarily exactly shining all the time, and your friends are fine and the food is good, and you also have to get your kid to school and get groceries. And so life goes on, and you get acclimated to the shock, and then it's a while before the next thing happens. And in that while, you can sort of think, oh, well, you know, I can still live in this, and I can still do good in the world, so maybe this is not the worst that can happen, and it's never the worst. In the U.S., we get these shocks almost daily. It's ICE invades a city. ICE kills a person. The United States goes and extracts a president of a sovereign country. A couple of months later, it kills the head of state of a sovereign country, not to mention all of the things that Trump says. And it just goes on. And you think, I can't go on. And then the next thing happens. So you're still getting groceries, you're still getting your kid to school, but what helps to just acclimate to this is that you've moved on to the next thing. And that last thing just doesn't feel quite as shocking as it was.
You write that there's a feeling that people talk about, that they feel that the space around them is getting smaller, like the walls are closing in. What is that space? What's disappearing here?
It's your ability to act. And it's measured in all sorts of ways, right? It's your ability to act in your profession, whether you're a lawyer, a professor, a journalist, I haven't been affected either as a professor or as a journalist, but I also feel like I'm lucky, right? I'm lucky to be working for the New York Times and for the City University of New York and not, say, for one of the universities that have reached an agreement with Trump, or, say, one of the newspapers or magazines whose publisher is shrinking space either in advance or in direct response to the Trump administration. It's your ability to act as a citizen, right? To protest, to vote. You just know there's less you can do today than you could do 2 weeks ago, and a week from now you're going to be able to do less than that.
You say that Trumpian news has a way of being shocking without being surprising. What do you mean by that?
A lot of the things that he does that shock us, or that he says that shock us, first of all, he's either said before, or he told us he was going to do, or if you gave yourself, or if I gave myself, the time and sort of the challenge to imagine what could happen next, they're not unpredictable. None of the shocking things that he has done, including the war in Iran, including Venezuela, including ICE in the streets of American cities and murders in the streets of American cities, none of this runs contrary to what he said he was going to do, and some of what he actually explicitly said he was going to do at some point. Right? So in that sense, they're not surprising, and they're absolutely shocking because this is not the kind of thing that should be happening. It's not the kind of thing that we could imagine happening even when he was telling us.
Maybe that's why he's so discombobulating, because on the one hand, you have a whole lot of lies coming out of his mouth all the time about absolutely everything under the sun. But then that's mixed with this extreme candor, this extreme, no, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to do this thing. I said I was going to do it, and now I'm going to do it. Is that what kind of messes with people's heads, that mixture of falsity and extreme candor?
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I've never thought of it quite that way, and I've never actually, it's never occurred to me to say this before, but maybe it's not terribly useful to think of these things as lies, right? Obviously, a lot of the things that he says are lies. But maybe what he is doing is he is telling us what the world looks like to him. And it is most useful to think to what he is saying compared to what actually is happening, but also listen to him because he's telling us what he thinks is happening, and he's portraying the logic within which he's acting. He's not entirely consistent, unlike somebody like Putin, who is just completely consistent. And if you listen to him tell you the story of the universe that he thinks he inhabits, it's 100% predictive. With Trump, he's in a different movie some of the time. But most of the time, you can kind of understand how he sees the world.
When Russia, after its brief, slightly tepid affair with democracy after the fall of the Soviet Union, slid back into autocracy, I don't think anyone was hugely surprised. Anyone who knows anything about Russian history under Stalin, under Peter the Great, Ivan the Terrible, to see it slide back into its old autocratic habits. But I think there's still great continuing shock in this country and perhaps in America too, that the United States of America, the self-proclaimed leader of the free world, is sliding away from democracy towards autocracy. But are there nonetheless deep roots in American history that kind of explain why a figure like Trump has emerged?
You know, I want to challenge what you said about Russia for a second, even though obviously you're right. Nobody was particularly surprised. But also none of this is predetermined. And most countries that have become better used to be worse. And I don't think that the hope for democracy or a better political future in Russia was entirely unfounded. You know, Ukraine is an example of a country that shares the same history as Russia in all the most meaningful ways, and yet has chosen an entirely different future. So we can't look for everything in a country's history. But where I will completely agree with you is, yeah, there's something particularly devastating about the, you know, the shining city on the hill, the world's policeman, the oldest electoral democracy.
Give us your poor, your tired, your huddled masses.
All of that. Like
yearning to be free.
You know, I thought that we always would always have that, and we don't. And there's something that I feel is just completely heartbreaking about the United States going that way. And yet, you're right. There's a lot of continuity in what's happening now And I think it's useful to think about the United States in many different ways at the same time, not just as the oldest existing electoral democracy, but also as a very young democracy that universalized the right to vote just over 50 years ago, as a country with a continuous and profound history of political violence, with only a few lulls that are fairly recent, as a country that hasn't dealt with deep divisions, race divisions, class divisions, incredible economic inequality that make it acceptable to exercise state violence against entire groups of people, as the country with the largest and one of the most inhumane carceral systems in the world. All of this feeds into what we're getting now.
A country where money has captured politics to an extraordinary degree as well.
And where the public rarely challenges that. You know, the idea that we have campaign debates. I don't know if people in the room know this, but people gain the right to participate in primary debates for either party, depending on how much money they have raised. Like, that's a measure of what?
I thought it was based on the kind of votes you got in the primaries, but it's based on money that's raised for your campaign?
Before you get to the primary, to the national primaries in the presidential election, you might wonder, how do they get these 7, 8, or 12, or 15 people on stage? It's based on how much money they've raised.
Donald Trump told us what he wanted to do, and now he's doing it. In a recent essay in the New York Times, you started ringing the fire bell, and your headline was, "State Terror is Here." In the United States, we've seen the shooting of two protesters by masked ICE agents on the streets of Minneapolis. What else is going on in the United States that hasn't been quite so loudly proclaimed on international headlines?
So I was actually writing in response to those two murders in Minneapolis. And what I wanted to focus on was that moment of discontinuity, right? Obviously, state violence, gun violence in the United States is old hat. And in particular, the murder of the motorist is something that is very familiar to Americans, except it's usually a black motorist.
Speaking of Renee Good, the right. mother of...
The woman who was executed in broad daylight while sitting in the driver's seat of her car. This is the man shooting through the driver's side window and killing somebody, the man in uniform, is a familiar sight to Americans, but the person sitting in the driver's seat is usually black. Why does that matter? Obviously not because it's okay to kill black people and not okay to kill white people, but because I was trying to decipher what are they trying to show us. And they're trying to show us that you can no longer predict who is going to be affected by state violence. You can no longer predict also who is going to be arrested. So first, Renee Good is killed. And I think then people say, you know, well, okay, she was at a protest and she was a lesbian and she was talking back to this guy. And then the next person who's killed is a white man with a license to carry a gun who works for the Veterans Administration. And I was in Minneapolis a few weeks ago and went to Alex Preti's memorial. And it's quite striking, right? There are all these American flags on it because he worked for the Veterans Administration. There's something, you know, the city perceives him as this guy that you plant U.S. flags on his memorial. And so I think that what that communicates is you can no longer say to yourself, I'm going to be safe if I do this or if I don't do that. And that's the difference between tyranny, which can create a very restrictive space, but it's a known space, right? You know what you're supposed to perform and where you're not supposed to go. And state terror, which may or may not be more restrictive, but it's unknown. It's meant to create a deep anxiety, a low-level dread in everybody in the country because there's a real threat of violence against everybody.
You grew up in the Soviet Union. Tell me the story of what happened to your grandfather during the 1930s, the period when Stalin was purging the Communist Party and having the NKVD, the secret police, just pick up probably millions of people, I think it's true to say.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because we still don't know how many. And I think about that a lot because it's partly we don't know how many because there's just so many. It's such a vast country. But partly we don't know how many because once you destroy records or make them secret, it's very, very difficult to know what happened. And so I'm particularly obsessed with archives and preserving records because of what happened in the Soviet Union. My grandfather was he was a deputy editor at a newspaper, and everybody got arrested. His boss got arrested. His colleagues got arrested. And he kept waiting for them to come and get him, and they didn't. And he lost his mind.
Why did he lose his mind?
Well, imagine what it would be like to just sit at home every night waiting for the police to take you away, knowing that it's probably to take you away to be executed. And so he eventually checked himself into a psychiatric institution, and he ended up volunteering for the front once World War II began from the psychiatric institution. But the reason that I was thinking about what happened to him was precisely because of that's sort of the corollary, right, of the effect of terror. Some of us say to ourselves, that's not going to happen to me because blank. And we make up stories about why it's not going to happen to me. And sometimes when it's so clear that it's going to happen to you, you just wait for it to happen. In fact, as we found out decades and decades later, these arrests were driven primarily by quotas. The secret police were told that they had to, in every region, arrest a round number. So different round numbers were handed down to different regions. Here you had to get 100,000, here you had to get 300,000, and then declare them to be enemies of the people and send them to the Gulag or to be executed. And those quotas, that randomness, right, that's the back end, and that we know is happening in Trump's America. We know that ICE has quotas, and we know that also Trump has made these promises of these round numbers of people that he's going to deport.
There was a newspaper report recently about a couple of British grandparents who were having a holiday in the United States. They had a valid visa. They were making preparations to cross the border to go and visit family in Canada. Their visa for Canada wasn't quite right, so they were sent back to the United States, were immediately arrested by ICE agents. This grandmother was thrown into a cell where she slept on the floor of the cell for 2 weeks. And when she was asking, why am I here? My US visa is actually still valid. She said that the guards there told her they had a quota to fill.
Right.
So is the randomness the point then?
The randomness is very much the point. The randomness is the point of terror.
In looking at the Trump administration, I want to talk about the leader, his lieutenants, and his followers, beginning with Trump himself. When Ronald Reagan was president, he was often quite detached from events and was an old movie actor and was often like a man playing the part of a president in a Frank Capra film or something like that. Is Trump like that? Is Trump the lead actor, the star of a TV show in his own mind? What do you think?
Well, I think my favorite psychological analysis of Trump, and these abound, right? And most of them I actually find pretty useless, but there's this one theory that Trump has no inner story, that his perception of himself is entirely external. And I find that so interesting. And it kind of helps me understand what I'm watching. Like, I'm watching him always acting in a movie. And he's a good actor in a movie. That moment when his ear was grazed during the attempted assassination, and the way that he rose and raised his fist in the air and, like, posed for the photo.
Fight, fight, fight.
Fight, fight, fight. It's so extraordinary. And you think about, you know, who is that brave? Like, nobody is that brave. But if he's in a movie, then I think inhabiting sort of that person who's rising up in defiance of this assassination attempt, who's also probably unkillable because, you know, he's in a movie. But also it helps explain to me when he's in the presence of a very charismatic person, he seems to be in a different movie. Like a couple of times when he's met with Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, he sort of come out like he's in a different movie. And when he met with Zoran Mamdani, he's in a different movie. So to answer your question, yes, I think he's always in a movie. Does that mean that he is detached from affairs of state? I don't think so, because we're all in his movie now. That is the affairs of state.
There was a moment in his first term where he had a meeting with Vladimir Putin, and he'd been told by his own intelligence officials that Putin had intervened and messed around with the 2016 election. And at the press conference afterwards, Trump disavowed his own security people. So I've spoken to President Putin. He assures me he did nothing of the kind, and I believe him. I used to think, and I think a lot of people used to think, that Putin had something on Trump, some compromising information. And then I think to myself, What could he possibly tell the world about Trump that would embarrass him?
That's the assumption of shame has always been faulty. But yeah, Trump does not appear to have any shame.
So why the love for Putin? Why
he was in Putin's movie.
He's in Putin's movie now.
He was at that point in Putin, like during that meeting and at that press conference, he was in Putin's movie. And like he had a choice, you know, did he want to be in his intelligence services movie, which would be kind of lonely and confrontational, or did he just want to bask in the limelight of Putin's movie?
There's another strange dynamic in the Trump administration. There's up is down, black is white, that kind of misinformation that goes on. There were 900 million people at his inauguration, and ingesting bleach is a great way to get rid of COVID-19. You describe his regime as practicing a kind of, quote, militant incompetence.
Well, that was the first Trump administration. The second Trump administration is much more militant and much more incompetent. And no, I mean, what I was talking about, and I'm not even sure that this argument needs to be made anymore after Doge, right? But during the first Trump administration, people were sort of looking at them and saying, oh, maybe he has an autocratic agenda, but he's too incompetent to advance it. And I thought, no, I think the incompetence is the point, because he made it so clear that he thinks that the whole business of governing is invalid, it's illegitimate. The government as America has constituted needs to be destroyed.
Like a deliberative process of government, you mean?
The deliberative, the institutionalized, the systems of checks and balances, you know, all those inspectors general who measure whether government is efficient or whether it's corrupt, whether, you know, all of that stuff.
All those people he hated when he was a property developer.
Exactly. He hated them even more once he got into office. He didn't quite know how to wield his incompetence against this incredible, actually, and there are obviously problems with government bureaucracy anywhere, and perhaps in the United States in particular, but still, when you're close to government, you realize there's an extraordinary amount of just accumulated competence, which is something that I think he viscerally hates. And so during his second administration, he came in with the guy with the chainsaw. And only now, about a year and 2 months after Doge went to war against the federal government, are we finding out really specific details, mostly thanks to lawsuits, about how that chainsaw was wielded. And it was wielded exactly in the sort of the militantly incompetent way. Like, for example, we now know that the National Endowment for the Humanities was gutted with the use of ChatGPT. They fed all these 20 or 25-year-old Doge employees who had no background in anything relevant to the job that they were supposed to be doing. They fed NIH grants into ChatGPT with the prompt, is this DEI? And if ChatGPT said, yes, this is DEI, oh, respond in 120 words or less, because apparently they were pressed for time. And so ChatGPT would say, yes, this is DEI, or no, this is not DEI. And most of what it found was DEI in ChatGPT's estimation, and so those grants were canceled.
Again, this kind of reminds me of life under communism. Friends who lived under communism told me how the reason why those economies crashed was partly because the theory wasn't great, but secondly because people kept getting appointed to posts who had nothing to recommend them except their loyalty. Is this what's going on in the United States now?
I think that's part of what's going on, and I think there's another similarity, which is that everything is so hollow. The loyalty that people had who were appointed in these communist countries, there was the personal loyalty, which usually got them the job, and then there was the loyalty oaths and the joining the Communist Party when it was required, the saying all the right words, the citing all the right sources if they were supposedly academics or other kinds of writers. All of this sort of hollow performativity is actually very similar. The point about these guys who are destroying the federal government in the United States is not that they believe in something that is antithetical to the people that they're dealing with, which is what they're saying, right? It's that they believe in absolutely nothing. I don't even think they necessarily believe that DEI is bad, or they believe anything about DEI, right? They just believe in destruction.
So this is why his lieutenants parrot absolute nonsense like, Rene Good and Alex Preti were terrorists, for example.
Right, because words have no meaning.
We recently saw Pete Hegseth, the Defence Secretary, former Fox News presenter, give an extraordinary speech where he said, in this conflict, the United States won't be bound by namby-pamby international law or the Geneva Convention. Again, there's this candor here.
You know, I'm not a big fan of that kind of candor. I think we all engage in some rituals, in some ritual speech when we do politics, or at least I hope we engage in some ritual speech. We sort of reaffirm some values, and maybe we don't entirely live up to all those values in our political lives or in our personal lives. But at least we say that we believe, you know, in the rule of law, and maybe we assert some humanist values, and we say that we're honest, and all those things that may not be 100% true, but they are aspirational, and they assert shared values. And when these guys take the stage and say, you know, there's no such thing as shared values, my only aspiration is to take as much power as I can and to kill or bomb or denigrate people whom I believe to be beneath me, I don't see the value in that kind of candor.
Let's move on to the MAGA tribes that support Donald Trump. There's an English writer from the early 19th century called William Hazlitt who wrote this wonderful essay where he seemed to kind of grasp this aspect of human nature. He wrote, "Man is a toad-eating animal. The admiration of power in others is as common to man as the love of it in himself. The one makes him a tyrant, the other a slave."
Such a great quote. I think the admiration of power is a really great insight. And I think that the totalitarian trade-off, and this is something that we, I think, don't talk about enough, especially in the United States. People really, especially on the Democratic side, do not understand this fundamental thing.
The totalitarian trade-off.
I'll get to the totalitarian trade-off in a second. But I think we don't understand this fundamental human need or human ability to see things, some things as more important than what's in their pocketbook. Democrats and political scientists generally assume that people will vote their economic self-interest. And to a lot of people, other things are more important, especially if voting their economic self-interest doesn't do them any good year after year, election cycle after election cycle. So the totalitarian trade-off is you are not going to be well off, as you haven't been, but at least you will belong to something great. And that belonging to something great is a kind of that's the relationship between the tyrant and the slave in Hazlitt's formulation. You get to be the slave, but you're my slave, right? And you have this relationship to this spectacular power that I keep demonstrating by bombing other countries, by removing dictators, by destroying the East Wing of the White House, by plastering everything with gold, by staging the biggest military parade ever. And you belong to this too.
Is there some kind of exhilaration then that some people in these circumstances experience that they feel in surrendering some of their autonomy, surrendering some of their independence to the dear leader, the great helmsman, the property developer in chief, or whoever it is at the top of the tree?
I don't know about exhilaration, but I think there's relief, right? And this is something that Eric Fromm wrote about in Escape from Freedom, which I think is one of the best books ever written about this particular phenomenon. He wrote it in 1940. This was after Hitler came to power. And his basic hypothesis is that there are times in human history when enough people feel dislocated enough, insecure enough, so scared about the future that a critical mass of people want to hand over their agency to someone else who basically says, I will take care of you and I will make the future predictable again.
Did you see this happen in Putin's Russia?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the 90s in Russia were that kind of dislocating moment of just, you know, people feeling like they had no idea where they lived, who they were, or what the future was going to look like.
And when the economy starts to tank as various sanctions and boycotts kick in against the Russian economy and people's standard of living goes down, that doesn't seem to affect Vladimir Putin's popularity?
It doesn't. And that's again, where it's really important to remember that the pocketbook is not the end-all be-all. People do not act in their economic self-interest, not because they're stupid, but because some things are more important to them than their economic well-being. But the other thing is that when you are at the precipice, then all you can do is think about how your family is going to survive. And the idea that you may purposely destabilize your country, right, by voting the tyrant out, if we suppose for a second that you have that power, that's actually a very frightening idea. You want to at least stay at the edge of the precipice.
Is this something we should perhaps bear in mind when we have hopes that the regime in Iran will be overthrown by people wanting their freedom back?
It's something we should always have in mind. But we should also bear in mind, I think more importantly right now, is that when bombs start falling on people, they do not tend to blame their leader for it. They tend to blame the people who are throwing the bombs.
You quote Hannah Arendt, who's, I think, going to be relevant for all time now. I think it's been long enough, I think we can safely say that, about the two qualities that she says characterises the audience, or the fans, if you like, of the autocrat: gullibility and cynicism. Can you explain how these two traits work together, the gullibility, then the cynicism?
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive at first, but I think what she's talking about is that the cynicism, and this will be recognizable to us now, is this assertion that the world is rotten, that everyone is driven by just craven self-interest, that there is no such thing as shared values. And then the person who just sold you on this idea that the world is rotten says, okay, believe everything I say. And it's an irresistible proposition, because the rug has just been pulled out from under your feet. You believe in nothing at this moment because the world is rotten, because we have no shared values. And so you enter into this agreement with the totalitarian leader to believe everything they say.
There's a moment in the Milan Kundera novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. The main character is the doctor called Tomáš, and during the Prague Spring, he writes this essay that's critical of the regime. And when that all comes to an end, he's brought in before the authorities and they say, look, everyone, let their heads run away from them, their pens run away from them. You just need to write this retraction. I mean, who cares? You know, it's no big deal. Just sign the retraction, we'll put it away, and you can go back to being a doctor. And he's about to do it, and he's thinking about it, and then he walks outside of his office, and one of his colleagues goes, did you sign it? You signed it, didn't you? You signed it, didn't you? That seems to be the key to this story. The kind of cynicism that seems to infect the larger society, where people want you to sign that document. What happens to people when they actually perform acts of courage, bravery, compassion, rebellion? How is that sometimes punished by the other people around them?
Yeah. You know, I've always been a little bit suspicious of that scene in Kundera's novel, even though I'm a big Kundera fan. But he was trying to figure something out about the essay that he had written about Czech destiny before Prague Spring was crushed. He wrote it before it was really became impossible to write politically, right? And when it became very dangerous to write politically, he left the country and stopped writing politically. So I think he was trying to negotiate something with himself, which, again, I'm not trying to stigmatize that, but I think it's, you know, that there's something very complicated going on there. But I think that for most people, the experience is the experience of not signing, right, or writing something or saying something, is the experience of breaking away from society. And that's what makes it so difficult. It's, for most of us, the drive to belong is much stronger than this need to hold on to factual truth. And I think that people for whom that drive to belong is not quite as strong are exceptional, which is why dissidents are a very small minority in any country.
I used to think that the iron rule of politics was that a politician would hang on to whatever power they had, no matter what. But I think one of the major and interesting spectacles of the Trump administration is how willing legislators, how willing members of Congress have been to resign the power that's apportioned to them by the Constitution to approve tariffs, to approve the act of going to war. What's going on here? What's that dynamic? Why are these politicians behaving so, I would think, really uncharacteristically here?
I don't think you're wrong. I think they're just thinking one step ahead. They're going to lose, if they exercise the little bit of power now, they're going to lose access to any power. I think that the cynical analysis of most politicians, certainly that's what we've seen with members of the Republican Party in the United States. Trump has shown them several times over. It didn't take that many, right? But he's shown several times over that he can commit electoral murder of anybody who stands up to him, any Republican who stands up to him. And so Republicans will either stand up and then resign or not run for re-election, or they will just make themselves accountable only to him and not to their voters.
Are you shocked by the lack of courage amongst America's elites at the moment?
You know, it reminds me of this conversation that I had with an Israeli political scientist years ago. And he was like, you know, I've been trying to figure out why people vote for autocratic leaders. And like, first I had this idea that Russians were a particular way. And then I had this idea that like Russian Israelis were a particular way. And then you people voted for Trump. And I thought maybe it's just human nature. You know, I had all these ideas. I've written books about why Russians conditioned by decades of totalitarianism act a particular way and why political power is so difficult to wield in Russia or to create in Russia, distributed political power. And then why institutions are so weak in Russia because they're so new. And then American institutions like American university, American law firms, American courts start caving to this aspiring tyrant.
I remember when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, right. One of the world's richest men, and the conventional wisdom at the time was, excuse the vulgarity of this language, was that it was going to be a good thing he took over the Washington Post because he had, quote, fuck you money. Talking to someone who actually has a fair bit of money about this some time ago, they said, there's no such thing as fuck you money. No one ever has enough money.
Mm-hmm. I had this exact conversation with somebody else, actually, I think I can quote him, Garry Kasparov, the chess champion, called me at one point and said, you know, I think so-and-so has so-and-so in his pocket. And I was like, well, why? Like, he's so wealthy. And Kasparov said, no, nobody ever has enough money. And wealth does not inoculate you against wanting more. But, you know, what I'm seeing with Bezos is so familiar. Because when Russian oligarchs owned media, and I worked for a couple of those oligarchs, and one in particular, I was editing a magazine that he owned, and I would meet with a representative of his every once in a while. And I remember there was a political campaign, and I was meeting with him, and he was like, you know, you have full independence, we totally guarantee your editorial independence. And then I met with him like 2 weeks later, and he said, they closed off the road to one of our factories. I said, I'd never imagined they could do that. But if they choke off the road, then, you know, we can't take stuff in and out, and that's it. And basically, like, the whole sort of media enterprise collapsed in the next few weeks. And I realized that one of the worst things that can happen to a media outlet is to be owned by somebody for whom it's not a primary business. So now I work for a family business, which may be the last, the New York Times, which may be the last journalism outlet in the country.
For all this talk of cowardice amongst the elites, then there's the people of Minneapolis, where ICE agents have been plucking people out of their beds and off the streets and shooting people dead while they're in their cars. Can you just explain what people in Minneapolis were doing at a ground level at the moment?
Well, I think that the Trump administration made a mistake with going to Minneapolis. I don't know this for a fact, but I assume that they thought that they were going to be targeting particular ethnic groups in Minneapolis, that Minneapolis is, they knew it was a Democratic city, but they also assumed it was a white city, where people weren't necessarily going to stand up for these immigrant communities. You know, they also thought it was a nice city, a city of nice, polite people. What they didn't realize was that they were going into the city where George Floyd was killed, that lived through a period of really profound political organizing, the creation of grassroots political networks and networks of mutual aid. And one of the first things that happened when ICE invaded Minneapolis, and it really, I think, felt to people there like an invasion, was that these mutual aid networks kicked in. And so people started delivering food to immigrant families who were afraid to go outside to get groceries, picking children up and taking them to school and bringing them home from school, again, for families where adults are afraid to leave the house. And then, of course, running physical interference where there were ICE raids. So there are these vast networks of people who are driving around, telling one another where ICE was, blowing their whistles. And that's what ICE encountered, was actual street-level grassroots resistance, which, unfortunately, and this is where the sort of the good news kind of ends, that kind of resistance results in this outsized, terrifying state violence.
Donald Trump's not a young man. Despite what his doctors say about him living to 200, he's not likely to do that. Once he's gone, how do you think societies are able to pull themselves out of that kind of debauching of their democratic institutions? How do they recover morally as societies from this?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we know about countries that have to, or societies that have to sort of reconstitute themselves after extreme upheaval, after a revolution, after genocide, after civil war, is that it all depends on what kind of story they can tell to themselves about themselves. And at the moment, the American story is not very promising. At the moment, it's a story about the best democracy ever created and this rogue president who hijacked this democracy and started destroying its institutions. It's basically the story that the Biden administration was telling, right? And it's a story about being able to go back to normal. It's a story that ignores all the things that made Donald Trump possible. And if he chokes on a cheeseburger tomorrow, we're not going to be able to recover by telling ourselves that story. There are other potential stories out there. There's the story that Zohran Mamdani, the new mayor of New York, tells, right? A story of a kinder society, a story of a diverse society, a story of a society that can be better than what we're used to. But that's not a story at the moment that the National Democratic Party is at all receptive to. It's still sort of in this place of thinking that it has to find some imaginary center and plant itself there, and then magically things will work out.
The U.S., regardless, will go on, will continue to be a global superpower for the foreseeable future. Well, down the track, but for the foreseeable future, I think we can say it'll continue to do so. But long-standing friends and allies, like Australia, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, will never see it the same way. Never see it the same way ever again. Only a fool would confidently expect America to honour its defence alliances. Now, this was the subject of Mark Carney's speech, the Prime Minister of Canada at Davos. This is a rupture. Something has profoundly changed. I have to ask, I don't even know if it's even important, but do people in the United States know this? Do they even care?
Yeah. You know, Americans, individual Americans, have a really, and here I include myself, because I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, we have a very bizarre relationship to this superpower that we're a part of. Somehow we think that we can just separate ourselves when it's convenient, travel the world in an American passport and expect to be welcome everywhere. Like, I don't expect to travel the world in a Russian passport and expect to be welcome anywhere. But somehow I still expect to, like, march through Australian customs with barely, you know, a visa requirement. I was thinking almost exactly 4 years ago, I left Russia for the last time as a reporter. I had left as a citizen quite a bit earlier, but as a reporter, I was there during the week of the full-scale invasion and then left to follow this incredible outflow of people, people who were just leaving the country because they couldn't stand to be a part of it. Because to them, it felt like being in there was like being in a plane that's bombing in a neighboring country, and they needed to parachute out. And I don't know anybody who feels that way about being in the United States or being an American citizen during the war in Iran. I don't know anybody who felt that way about the United States when it went into Venezuela. I don't know what it would take to increase Americans' awareness of themselves as having responsibility for what the United States does.
Australia is by no means as dynamic or as powerful or rich a country as the United States, but we do elections better in this country.
You do.
We have an independent electoral commission. We have the vote on a Saturday. There's compulsory voting, because voting is seen as not just as a privilege, but as a duty, a civic duty. The polling places are kind of like little mini festivals of democracy that go on. There are kids pinging around all over the place. You know, we have the what we call a democracy sausage, where money's being raised for the local scout group or what have you, or a local music group or something.
And is there sausage?
There's a sausage. On bread. It's kind of like a really lame and very, very greasy hot dog, but it's surprisingly delicious. We do this very well. Well, last time I was in the United States, I'm talking to American friends and they're bemoaning the state of American electors. And I say, well, this is how we do it in Australia. Maybe I'm a very boring person, it's very possible, but I can just see them sort of going, you know, their minds wandering. They're just really not that curious. Right. Americans really do believe they have the gold standard of democracy and can't be done better elsewhere, don't they?
They really do. And that's still, right? They still just want to go back to normal. You know, we vote on Tuesday. Depending on which state you live in, it can be very difficult to register to vote. It is getting increasingly more difficult to actually cast your vote, even if you're registered to vote. You have to show particular kinds of ID. You have to make it to the polling place on a work day in time. If you're dropping off your ballot, you can be in a place like Houston County, where you have to drive for miles to that one drop-off place, where another county that's geographically much smaller may have one drop-off place for a couple of thousand people. Young people in the United States don't vote. Statistically, we know this. Most Americans probably, if you ask them, will say, oh, it's because they're not interested. Well, no, actually, it's because for most of them, it's very difficult to get to register to vote. It's very difficult to get to a polling place because there's a concerted policy against having polling places on college campuses or near college campuses, which tend to be quite isolated. Young people are the people who are least likely to be able to take time off on a Tuesday. I can go on and on, but let me just mention one thing. A law recently passed in the state of Georgia that makes it illegal to give water or food to people waiting in line to vote. Right? This is the extent...
So illegal?
Illegal.
Illegal.
Yeah, illegal to give water or food, right? That's like the opposite of sausage, I think.
It's kind of suitable. It's like the democracy drought then, isn't it? Rather than... Em, you're a non-binary person. You're Jewish and you're a migrant to the United States and you've been an activist for LGBT rights in the past. Do you ever think there might have to come a time where you have to leave?
Oh, it's entirely possible. I mean, I think that... And this is another thing that's quite familiar to me from living in Russia, because one day I'm like, you know, we have to do all these repairs in our house, and it's a major investment. And another day I'm like, well, we have to go to Canada, or if not Canada, then where? And
Anthony Albanese signing asylum visas today for Iranian soccer sports people. Maybe one for you as well. Has Albo offered you a visa, I wonder, at this stage? Not yet?
Well, a couple of years ago, as you may know, I actually had a very difficult time getting a visitor's visa.
Oh, that's embarrassing, isn't it? Yeah, I do.
Because the Russians have convicted me in absentia for my reporting on war crimes in Ukraine.
Does that mean you're on an Interpol list as a result?
Yeah, I'm internationally wanted because I'm sentenced to 8 years in Russian prison. But yeah, if there's a sign up sheet.
Just finally, do you think the United States might have to reinvent itself when it comes out of this situation?
The United States will absolutely have to reinvent itself. I've just given you a little bit of a taste of the American voting system. And then, you know, we've talked a little bit about our two-party system, where one party has become an autocratic party and the other party is is a party of money and this insane idea of some imaginary center, and it's a gerontocracy. But most importantly, it's a country whose political language has become hollow, which is what makes it so easy to abuse and dismiss. And we're going to have to invent a new story and a new language.
It's been amazing speaking with you, M. Gessen.
Thank you, Richard.
Please give a gigantic thank you to M. Gessen. M. Gessen's most recent book is called Surviving Autocracy. Huge thanks to everyone at the Brisbane Powerhouse and the Brisbane Writers' Festival, and to Steve Fieldhouse for the recording. Producer was Alice Moldovan. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.